From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's got to be some perfectly good reason why we're all grossed out by the idea of cannibalism. And for much of human history, we have been. We've seen it as an unthinkable taboo, not to mention a glitch in nature. But Bill Shutt says cannibalism is not, in fact, unnatural. You will find plenty of examples of creatures eating their own kind. Lions, polar bears, and chimps. Baby sharks, sometimes they eat their siblings. Amphibians, sometimes they eat their own mother. And not just because of stress or overcrowding. This is part of a process. Bill Shutt is joining us today to talk about cannibalism. And yes, you've got to include human cannibalism in the picture. We've got our own history on the subject. Join us after the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out the Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few years ago, the American Film Institute named its top screen villains of all time. Darth Vader was in there, of course, the Joker, Nurse Ratchet. But the villain on the top of the list, number one, Hannibal Lecter, the murderous, man-eating psychiatrist in Silence of the Lambs. And Bill Shutt says there's no surprise that Lecter is on the top of this list, given the way most human cultures think about cannibalism. It's an unthinkable taboo and understood mostly as unnatural, the result of some glitch in some system. But Shutt has found, actually, that's not true, that there are perfectly good reasons for creatures to eat their own kind. This is actually something of a theme in Shutt's work. He's a zoologist and a professor of biology at Long Island University, and his first book was about another misunderstood and often gruesome practice found in nature, vampirism, blood feeding, which has the same kind of reputation as cannibalism, the way it's depicted in popular culture, for example. So Shutt took on the myths of vampirism, and he explained how and why it worked in nature, and so he told us, cannibalism seemed like the perfect follow-up.
When you mention cannibalism, you have that same type of knee-jerk reaction. You either think of Jeffrey Dahmer and criminal cannibals, or you think about the Donner Party or the guys that were stranded up in the Andes. And so doing some of the initial research, I noticed that there were some really sensationalized books out there. And then on the other side of the fence, there were some extremely academic books that were written for people who were working on specific groups of animals. And there was really nothing in the middle, especially nothing that covered the entire animal kingdom. So I just felt that this was a great place for me to step in. And I'm a college professor, and I think that one of the ways that I can be successful is to be entertaining and to inject humor where appropriate. And this is what I tried to do. So you have this topic that seems to be horrible, the worst taboo that you can think of, and I'm there to let my reader know that there are other aspects of it that may be far more interesting than what they've ever thought about when they think of the word cannibalism, which is extremely widespread, which I found out.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah. I mean, up until fairly recently, the party line among scientists had been that, except for a couple of well-known examples, black widow spiders, praying mantises, that cannibalism in the animal kingdom was aberrant behavior that generally took place when there wasn't enough food or in overcrowding situations due to captivity. And it was only over the last 20, 25 years that we began to realize that cannibalism takes place in the animal kingdom for all sorts of reasons that have nothing to do with that. So that was a huge surprise. And I think it will be to my readers as well. And it's only been fairly recently that some researchers have synthesized all of the work that had been out there. A lot of scientists had worked on their own sort of specialized animal groups, and nobody really put together the big picture until fairly recently.
How difficult was it to stay away from the cliches and the sensational part of it. It seems like that's the we have some sort of almost biological impulse that finds this revolting and fascinating at the same time, it seems.
Yeah, well, I mean, don't get me wrong. There's certainly some material in this book that people might get grossed out about, but I didn't want to write a book about criminal cannibals. I didn't want to glorify them. Some of the victims' families are still alive. Some of them are still alive. And I had no interest in sort of adding to the list of books that these guys may read and enjoy and think that they're, you know, somehow superstars. Plus the fact I'm a zoologist, I'm not a criminal psychologist. And so it was easier for me to avoid that material because there was so much in the realm of zoology that was so rich as far as, different types of cannibalism, different types of behavior, very weird stuff. And then once I got into working with human cannibalism, you know, for example, I thought that the Donner Party had been, here's the most arguably the most famous example of cannibalism in the United States, at least. And I thought, well, this has got to be well done, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time doing this. But I was really lucky in that there was breaking news on several fronts about the Donner Party. And, right. And so I was able to go in there and take a look at some of the new work that was being done on what I thought was a topic that I wouldn't be spending much time on.
What's interesting about the Donner Party, and I think we'll probably come back to this, but the story of the Donner Party seems to express how cannibalism is a function, or seems to be anyway, a function of extreme conditions or the way we respond to starvation in particular. That section of the Donner Party is about what happens, for example, to the human mind and the human body as it's going through starvation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there were studies that were done during World War II that looked at the physiological effects of starvation. And so when you look at the Donner Party through the lens of that information, you can see why certain things happened. I'm not condoning their behavior. I'm not saying they were right or wrong. All I'm saying is that it was a natural response to horrible conditions.
The idea of environmental conditions comes into play here. Overcrowding.
Absolutely.
And we'll come back to the effects of the aridification. I'm not sure. Desertification, I guess, is the right word of the effects of climate change on this issue. But say something broadly about that. Again, environmental conditions play into the way this story plays out.
Absolutely. Whether you're looking at across the animal kingdom or with humans, you know, the changing environments, environmental stresses, these are the factors that drive a lot of this behavior. Whether it's cannibalism related to reproductive behavior or parental care or a lifeboat strategy, you know, a lot of this has to do with the fact that the environments are unpredictable.
Cannibalism, you write, occurs in every class of vertebrates, from fish to mammals. What are the ones that interested you the most as you started to dig in here?
Some of the more interesting, where I just sat there and my jaw literally dropped, were what was a local species called the sand tiger shark. And this is a species of shark, like the blue shark and others, where the eggs hatch internally. And so there are two oviducts. There's a right and a left oviduct. And the eggs are develop at different rates. And so what happens on the right side and simultaneously on the left is that the sharks that are born first, once they go through the yolk that they're carrying with them, they start to eat the lesser developed eggs. Yeah. And once those are consumed, the eggs start to hatch internally. And the two oldest sharks start to eat the newly hatched brethren. And so by the time they're born, there is only two of them, one from the right side, one from the left side. And in a sense, they've already gone through a training regime to be predators.
Yeah.
I found that incredible.
The older members of the brood eating smaller siblings. It seems like a theme in the animal world.
Yeah. The big guy eating the small guy is generally the way it works out. And so for a while there, the party line was that well, males get eaten more than females. And in reality, it's the reason that occurs is because in many of those instances, if not all of them, the females are larger than the males.
When did we get this idea that cannibalism was not natural? Because it seems like it's entirely natural throughout the animal world.
Well, I used to have a chapter that was, before it got changed, the name of the chapter originally was Blame It on the Greeks. And so I was really interested in looking at the origin of the cannibal taboo. And so a historian by the name of Mary Knight and I set out at the Museum of Natural History to sort of explore that question. And what we came up with was that it seems that this started with the writings of the ancient Greeks.
Yeah, like Homer.
With Homer and then Herodotus and then moved to the Romans, and the theme became that cannibalism was the worst type of revenge. It was the worst thing that you could do. It was the worst taboo. It was something that monsters did. You know, Polyphemus, the Cyclops, and then once you got into William Shakespeare and Titus Andronicus, for example, this party line continued. And Daniel Defoe with Robinson Crusoe, right, and the Brothers Grimm. And it just went on and on to the point where in the West, there is this now knee-jerk reaction whenever you hear the word cannibalism. And I think that it is, one of the themes that runs through this book is that culture is king, and that our culture for 2,000 years now plus has literally dictated to us that cannibalism is the ultimate taboo. In other cultures that did not get that indoctrination, they came up with their own cultures, right, their own belief system, their own funerary rites, and these really, throughout history, have come to, there have been clashes between the West and the indigenous people that they met because of the fact that they practice behavior that the Westerners perceived of as inhuman.
It's interesting how these taboos are come about, as you say, as a function of literary cautionary tales,
sure,
mythology. So what happens in cultures that aren't affected by those Western myths? What do we see developing in other cultures?
Well, they develop their own burial rites, for example.
Right.
In the 1960s and 70s, anthropologists went into Brazil, into the Brazilian Amazon, and they encountered a group called the Waré. They were mortified to learn that the Waré consumed their dead. And they did this in ritual fashion. It wasn't, there was really, if you look at it now, there's really no savagery involved. They were dealing with their loved ones in a way that they thought was appropriate. And what interested me is that the Waré were just as horrified to find that the Westerners were burying their dead.
Yeah.
It was along the lines of, how could you put your dead in the ground to rot and be eaten by worms? Why would you do that? Why would you do that to them? Why would you do that to the living who have to, exist knowing that their rotting relatives are right outside? So it's once again, it's culture is king. And if you don't get this idea force-fed to you that cannibalism is the worst thing that you can do, then all sorts of other rituals could evolve around that, whether it has to do with funerary rites or culinary cannibalism or things that might be appropriate after a battle.
It's interesting. So one of the theories is that this revulsion is cultural, and that seems to be the one that plays out. But what about, because you write about this, the other hypothesis that our aversion to cannibalism is hardwired into our genetic blueprint, that for sanitary reasons related to natural selection, it just didn't make any sense to be cannibalistic. What? How did that idea play out as well?
Sure. What you say is absolutely true. I think that there are certainly reasons why cannibalism does not work and is not selected for in certain instances. The first has to do with a If you're an evolutionary biologist, there's a metric called inclusive fitness, which is a measure of how many genes there are of yours in a population. And they don't have to be your, it doesn't have to be your children. It could be, you know, more distant relatives. But if you are eating your relatives, whether they're close relatives or not so close, you are taking those genes out of the population and therefore decreasing this evolutionary measurement, inclusive fitness. So that's one. The second has to do with the fact that there are diseases that are species and parasites that are species specific. Right. And they've developed, let's say we're talking about parasites, they've developed the ability to overcome your immune system. Now you're eating the same species and you're ingesting these parasites, which may now have a leg up on the fact that they don't have to overcome your immune system because they've already evolved to do that. The real trouble comes from cannibalism-related diseases, at least for humans, and the most famous being Kuru,
right,
which is a neurological disease that was first discovered by researchers who went into New Guinea. And after World War II, it started, and through the 1950s and 1960s, they wondered why the indigenous Highlanders in New Guinea, why many of them were dying from this horrible neurological disease.
Yeah.
And they thought, well, it might be poisoned water. It could be a shock that they've met these Westerners. But what they discovered was that there is a contagion, whether it is a prion, which is in theory, it's a self-replicating protein, or a virus that no one has really pinpointed yet. I'm still on the fence with this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that a call has been made about what the real cause of this is. But what happens is that it's 100% lethal. It literally tears your nervous system down. There's no cure, and it's horrific. And these researchers found that it was taking place because the foray, as part of their funeral rites, the women and the children were consuming body parts.
Right.
And if they consume body parts of an infected individual, then they would get this disease.
Say a little bit more, if you would, about the foray. You mentioned in the book the foray believed it was better to be consumed by a loved one than, for example, by decay or maggots. And so they had this, I have to say, on some level, once you kind of get past that Western impulse to be disgusted by it, there's something kind of lovely about the idea, I have to say.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I'm not certain that I could ever do that, but once again, you have to respect the fact that you know, these people didn't make this up on the spot. For generations, they were taught that this is how you took care of your very sick, and then when they passed away, how you took care of your departed loved ones. And the strange thing, one of the things that researchers found to be really weird before they knew what was going on, was that men were not coming down with this disease.
Right.
It was mostly women and children. And so Shirley Lindenbaum, who is an anthropologist that I've come to befriend, she and her husband asked the question, what is it that the women and the children are doing that the men aren't doing? And the answer was cannibalism, because the men did not partake in these funerary feasts. They would it was women from different villages. Loved ones would be called. Children would be taught that this was, you know, this these were the rites that they would be that carrying out throughout their lives. And they would consume body parts. They would cut them up and they would cook them. Obviously not at a temperature that would destroy either a virus or these prions, and then they would consume them.
It's Bill Shutt. His book is called Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. The This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about cannibalism. The zoologist Bill Shutt says cannibalism is perfectly natural. His book is called Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. Let's go back to the animal kingdom for a bit here. I wanted to ask you about sexual cannibalism is interesting, and these mantis myths, which I have to say I kind of believed that, you know, a female mantis will bite off the head of her partner during sex. And there were all kinds of theories and ideas about that. But it turns out that's not exactly accurate. And it's another one of these myths that you deal with.
Yeah, there. First of all, when you say mantises, there are 2,200 species.
Right. I shouldn't say mantis to a to a zoologist. Yeah, I need to be more specific.
And so, only a few of them have been shown to engage in cannibalism, and it turns out that a lot of these initial studies that were done in captive conditions where the females were starved.
Right.
And this is right along the lines of the black widow spiders, where the same thing took place early on. You know, everybody knows that black widow spiders are cannibals. Nobody knows that the initial work, these initial observations were done on females that had been denied food. So getting back to the mantids. Yeah. So we believe that while cannibalism does occur and there are interesting reasons that make sense, it's probably not as widespread in the praying mantises as one might have been led to believe.
This is a theme. When a creature is deprived of food, often cannibalism is part of the reaction. Let's talk about another one of the conditions for cannibalism, when things get too crowded. And it seems like the ideal example for this is the Mormon cricket.
Yeah. Mormon crickets, spadefoot toads, they were two of the creatures that I found most interesting. And the spadefoots I had the experiences with. But Mormon crickets are kind of an interesting group. First of all, they're not crickets. They're really katydids. And
yep.
And they undergo these huge hatchings where there are millions of these creatures. And they swarm. And the swarms are often, a mile wide. And so they move through the countryside and consume everything, every piece of plant matter, every bit of protein that they can get. But what happens is that, it's been determined that this is a forced march, because if you break a leg, if you slow down, then the guy in back of you will eat you. And researchers have found that this is really a drive for protein and salt. That they are, compelled to move forward, and anything in their path, they'll eat it.
You mentioned chickens in unnatural settings when they're packed shoulder to shoulder,
mm-hmm.
may engage in cannibalism.
Yeah. Well, you have the pecking order, which
right.
is which means that some birds are going to get at the food more readily than other birds. So this is a fairly natural behavior. Now, in the early 1900s, when poultry farms got larger, but the technology had not caught up with the fact that these poultry farms were now dealing with thousands and thousands of birds rather than hundreds of birds, there was overcrowding, and because of this overcrowding, there was a lot more of this pecking order of the things that take place when you're dealing with crowded birds. And that was the fact that if these chickens saw red, that they would kill the other birds and kill and consume them. And so this got to be a big money loss for poultry farmers. And so they did things like snipped off their beaks, and that was painful, and it was kind of probably a hassle to do that. And the National Band and Tag Company out of Pennsylvania came up with a solution, and that was to fit each of these birds with a tiny set of sunglasses. Yes. And they were red gels, and they would pivot as the bird looked down. So if it was looking down to sort of peck at some feed, it would see the ground, and it would see the seed feed normally. But when it looked outward, the lenses would drop into place, And so basically the birds were seeing the world through rose-tinted glasses, and they would not get all worked up if they saw a bit of red.
I want to ask you about mammals. Right now you say about 75 mammal species practice some form of cannibalism, which is, I mean, that's a tiny fraction when you think about something like, I think you say 5,700 species of mammals.
Yeah, sure. And once again, I think that there, as people start to do work on this, I'm sure there are going to be many, many more species that are found to be to cannibalize. But this is a number that these are studies that have been done. So there are plenty of similar species to the animals that have already been shown to be cannibals, that where there just hasn't been the research to go out and say, well, these are cannibals. But I've got no doubt that that number will increase.
Yeah.
But across the animal kingdom, there's certainly less cannibalism among the mammals than there are in, say, fish, for example.
Chimpanzees, though, have a fairly common, it seems, at least that's the sense, experience with cannibalism.
Yeah, and they do it for several reasons. Probably the most common reason would be to terminate the maternal care of an infant that's not yours. Some of these female chimpanzees will change groups, will switch groups, social groups, and if they've got a baby with them, then you're talking about a commitment of several years before the mother will come into estrus again. And by killing the baby and oftentimes then eating the baby, you terminate that mother's maternal investment, and they'll be more readily accepted into the group and ready to mate. This is a type of cannibalism that happens in many of the big cats, like lions, and it also happens in bears, happens in sea lions. So this is this type of cannibalism related to reproductive behavior is quite common.
Do anthropologists think that some of what we're seeing in terms of the cannibalism among large primates, does that give us any indication about earlier humans, for example, of the way they potentially could have behaved in terms of cannibalism?
Yeah, I think what you're looking at is if there is a dead animal there in front of you and you're hungry, that it doesn't really matter to animals if it's your species or if it's another species. This is a food item, and you're probably going to consume it. And I really believe that there is no difference when you're talking about ancient humans, or if you're talking about primates, or you're talking about any number of other types of mammals, you're talking or non-mammals, dinosaurs, for example. You know,
right.
I can't imagine that if a dinosaur came across the body of if a T-Rex came across the body of another T-Rex, it's not going to look at it and go, "Oh no, there's Larry. I can't do this." You know, this is food, and things are tough, and so you eat food when it's presented to you. So I think that this is a common thread that you'll see throughout the animal kingdom.
There's another myth that you deal with that I wanted to say something about briefly, and that is this idea that has emerged over the past, say, 10 years or so, that polar bears are being driven to cannibalism as a result of, you know, global warming, shrinking sea ice or something. Turns out it's more complicated than that, I guess.
Yeah. Starting in 2010, there were a bunch of really sensationalized shots and headlines showing polar bears dragging around the bodies or body parts of polar bear cubs. And so the headlines stated lack of polar ice driving polar bears to cannibalism, global warming making making polar bears cannibals, all along that type of line. And so this got a lot of people, you know, this got a lot of people looking at it, and it attracted a tremendous amount of media coverage. Until we realized that, that polar bears and other bears have been feeding on their own kind and for thousands and thousands of years, and that this was readily known by scientists, in the late 19th, early part of the 20th century, we've known that that this behavior occurs. Now what happened was some scientists wrote a paper where they described some instances where this type of cannibalism took place in places where they'd never seen it before, in places where females generally took their cubs so that they would not run into males. But in these several instances, for whatever the reason, and they didn't really have an explanation for it, the females and their cubs ran into hungry males and they were killed and eaten. Now, global climate change deniers jumped all over this because they said, well, look at this. This is just another lie that they're trying to foist on, that scientists are trying to foist on the public, because they knew from the start that polar bears ate their young for 100 years or more. And look what they're trying to do now, convince us that it's that it's global climate change that's turned these animals into cannibals. In reality, it was the media that did it. They took the reports of the scientists, which mentioned this fact, but they left out that part. They left out the part of the research that they didn't find interesting, was that cannibalism had been occurring for a long time, and just concentrated on the fact that cannibalism was taking place. And there was a suggestion that one of the reasons why this cannibalism might have happened in these three instances was because the sea ice might be breaking up earlier because of global climate change. Nobody was making a direct correlation, yet that's not what the media did.
I think this one of the strangest stories you tell in the book concerns these legless amphibians called Sicilians. Basically, the fetus consumes the lining of the mother's oviducts, and it sounds just incredible. I have to say, sorry to put it this way, but it sounds incredibly creepy.
Yeah. This to me was maybe the most fascinating of the animals. And if I can back up a second, just explain that Sicilians are amphibians, so they're the same groups as say frogs and toads and salamanders. They're legless. Yeah. They live under the ground. And so they're worm-shaped. There are two major groups of these. Some lay eggs, and others give birth to their live young. And researchers in the 1970s, Marva Lee Wake out of University of California, when she was looking at some of the newborns, she realized that they had a weird tooth. And before they could figure out what it was using that tooth for, the tooth fell off. And so she wondered, what would the sense be of a baby being born with a tooth that dropped out immediately after birth? So they looked at they dissected some of the females that had been pregnant, and they found that the regions of the oviduct where the babies had been developing, the lining had been eaten away. And so they examined the lining, and they found that, this once again was not aberrant behavior. The lining was really rich in fat and nutrients, and that this was basically a form of parental care that these babies went through in order to survive, in order to get nutrition. So scientists thought, well, that was really cool, and then they took a look at the egg-laying versions of the Sicilians, and there had been some descriptions where by scientists that said that, well, once the eggs hatch, the babies will squirm all over their mom for several weeks. And it's kind of strange, and we're going to take a closer look at it. And when they did, what they found out was that the babies were not only squirming all over their moms, but they were grabbing onto her skin and peeling it like a grape and consuming it. And this was, once again, natural behavior. The mother's skin would grow back within a day or so. They would peel it again. And this would go on for several weeks. So these were just two really neat examples. And we believe that the egg layers were here first. And that so they were already equipped with this tooth to do the peeling. And that when live-bearing species evolved, they had already been pre-adapted to this type of behavior. And instead of peeling their mother's skin from the outside, they peeled the oviductal lining inside their moms before they were born. I just thought that was a fascinating story.
So did I. Bill Shutt, his book is called Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the zoologist Bill Shutt. We're talking about his book, Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. Let's talk about cannibalism in the Bible. What did you learn about cannibalism from the Bible?
Well, that there are two types of what I would consider to be cannibalism mentioned in the Bible.
Yeah.
One of them is the more typical survival cannibalism when the cities of Jerusalem and Samaria were besieged, and that cannibalism is described as having taken place inside those cities. But the second has to do with the concept of transubstantiation, that the Eucharist, that the body and blood of Jesus Christ are actually being consumed during communion. And so, you know, you would think, and I thought, that like other types of religious beliefs, that this would be seen as sort of a symbolic type of gesture, kind of like Jesus saying, I am the vine or I am the gate. I mean, I don't think anybody thought he was a vine or that he was a gate. But for the Roman Catholics, there's no symbolism involved.
Right.
If you're taking communion, you are literally consuming the body and blood of Jesus Christ. So to me, that's interesting. What was even more interesting was the fact that, you know, well, we may think, well, you know, that's harmless, that's their belief, and that's fine, and that's certainly my take on the matter. But back hundreds of years ago, this was something that caused thousands of people their lives, and that was because there were folks, mostly Jews, who were persecuted for abusing the host, for crimes against the host. And so the proof was, this guy would report that when they went to take the host out on Sunday, it was bleeding, it was red, and so who did this? Well, it must have been the Jews.
Yeah.
So in reality, what we believe nowadays is that, so these folks were arrested for, and there are some really interesting wood carvings that show this, the progression where the Jews kidnap the host, and then they do all these kinds of nefarious acts, and then the good Christians come in and arrest them and torture them, put them to death, and everybody else who sort of might be hanging out in their neighborhood. And this went on for hundreds of years until I think they ran out of Jews and they found other groups to persecute. And these became gypsies and witches. But what they found out in the 20th century was that these so-called bleeding hosts were probably bleeding because of a bacteria called Serratia murkescens, which is a bacteria that's found just about everywhere, and it produces a red pigment called prodigiosin, and this prodigiosum was the substance. It's an antibacterial substance, so we think that these bacteria produce it to kill other bacteria, kind of like penicillin does.
Yeah.
And so this was mistaken for being blood, and this is probably the explanation for bleeding some of the bleeding statues. But you know, it's a funny story until you realize that thousands of people were put to death because of a belief that they had been torturing the host.
There's another practice that I had no idea about. This practice of so-called medicinal cannibalism that really spans hundreds of years. This idea that consuming human tissue or human crushed up human bones was a kind of curative.
Yeah, this was the biggest surprise to me with regard to human cannibalism, you know, whereas, you know, in the animal kingdom, it was how widespread it was. When I found out that for, as you say, for hundreds of years, starting in the Middle Ages, spanning the Renaissance, and lasting right up until the early part of the 20th century, just about every body part that you can imagine, from skulls and bones to blood and guts and fat, were used throughout Europe to prepare all sorts of medicinal preparations, from salves to potions and powders to cure just about everything you can think of, and this went on for, as we said, hundreds of years. Rich people, poor people, scientists, great writers. And everyone did it, and until they historians sort of made it disappear, and and that to me that just blew me away. And really, the last remnants of that medicinal cannibalism, I think, are folks who eat placentas.
That's still going on.
Yeah, small groups of folks, alternative medicine people who follow alternative forms of medicine. Believe that by consuming their placentas, that they can smooth out the ups and downs of hormone ups and downs that take place after you give birth.
It's interesting. Seems like one of the themes in this story is that our ideas about so-called cannibals, in some way, was just kind of deflection and racism. Especially when you look at, for example, Columbus and some of the impressions of the native peoples and some of these, island chains, for example. Talk a little bit about that dimension, because this was really kind of troubling.
Yeah, the word cannibalism, because of the Western taboo, the word cannibalism means all of these horrific things to us. So when Columbus came to the New World, initially the people that he met, he got along really well with, and he described them as nice and, you know, fit to work, and pretty much anybody who was not going to fall into line, they were excluded and hunted down. Now, you have to remember that Columbus was really there to find gold, and when he didn't find gold, he turned to another resource, and that resource was humans. And so Queen Isabella basically told him that if these people are good people and kind people and can be taught and will, you know, become good Christians, then you can't enslave them. But if they're cannibals, then in a sense, all bets are off and you can do anything you want to them. Certainly, she didn't say it in those words, but probably not remarkably, the next three voyages of Columbus were more like armed invasions. And so people were enslaved, murdered, everything was stolen from them. Why? Because suddenly these people who had been these kind, gentle, indigenous folks were now, lo and behold, found out to be cannibals. And so really they weren't humans anymore. So these missions became more like pest control. So you could kill them, you could sell them into slavery, and you could literally destroy their cultures because they were not human. And so this took place first in the Caribbean, then in Mexico, certainly took place in South America, places like Africa, where the concept of the other, and that's what cannibals were. They were the other. Anybody who resisted became a cannibal in a sense. Mm. And so that you weren't dealing with humans, and you could literally do whatever you wanted to them. And so this became a very popular way to justify annihilating indigenous people.
That's one end of the sort of the spectrum that you write about. The other end is this idea that comes in 1979 from this anthropology professor, William Ahrens, who wrote this book called The Man-Eating Myth. And he starts this big debate, and you spend a good amount of time with this in the book, that he believed there was absolutely no physical proof of ritualized cannibalism in early human cultures. So that's the other end of the spectrum. What mm-hmm. it seems where you've come down is probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I spoke to Bill Ahrens, who teaches at Stony Brook University on Long Island, where I live. And so I went in there having read his book, thinking the same thing that a lot of folks who read it in 1979 thought, well, my God, how could he be saying these things? How could he make statements that no ritual cannibalism has ever taken place? There's no proof of it. That's absurd. And I think that in my discussion with Ahrens, what I came away with was that what he did was generate a tremendous amount of interest in the topic. Nobody was talking about the other. Nobody was talking about what Columbus did and how he used cannibalism as in a sense as a club to bludgeon indigenous people until 1979, and people started to read this book, The Man-Eating Myth. And so what I really think that Ahrens wanted anthropologists to do, and what he succeeded in doing, is one, have an idea about the fact that a lot of these claims of cannibalism might not have been true, and there may have been ulterior motives for why people were accused of being cannibals. And two, and to me this was, I think, probably just as important to him, that we needed to be more rigorous when we were looking at proof before we called people cannibals. So, for example, if in the old days, if you found a bunch of bones that had cut marks on them, then the group in question that had made these cut marks on the bones were declared to be cannibals. Nowadays, not so much. Now, not only do you have to find these specific types of manipulation of the bone and cutting of the bone and crushing of the bone, but you also have to find those bones in proximity to the bones of game animals that have been processed in the same way. And I believe all of these things came out of this discussion that Ahrens initiated.
Let me ask you finally, one of the things you really work through in the book is you raise the question of what would it take for cannibalism to become widespread behavior? What sort of environmental conditions, for example, or circumstances? And one of the things you write about is something that seems to be a concern to you, that this idea of being desensitized to violence and gore. Say something about that, because you say it's a trait that does not bode well for the future.
No, I think that, you know, I was a child of the 60s, so I grew up when everybody was shocked to see movies like The Wild Bunch and Bonnie and Clyde. You know, we'd never seen anything like that before. Yeah. And since that time, we have truly become desensitized to that type of gore and violence, to the fact where, you know, we sort of shrug it off nowadays. You know, we're less horrified by that type of thing. Now, I think we need to be careful about saying that, you know, I don't necessarily believe that cannibalism is going to become widespread in the future. I certainly hope that it doesn't, and it would be horrific if it did. But when you look at mass cannibalism in the past, when these are instances that generally took place after famine or during famines in places like China or Russia, and probably more recently in places like North Korea. And so this is natural behavior. When you are in a condition, for example, like the Donner Party folks were, where their bodies are literally consuming themselves. There's not only is there no more food, but you've gone through all of your fat, and your body is now breaking down its own proteins into amino acids. And when you're getting into that point, now you're either going to die or you're going to consume the dead. And many, many times in the past, in these types of situations, cannibalism has taken place because of this type of horrific stress and starvation. Now, with that said, if these types of instances in places where, for example, and this is just a for example, you know, it used to be a dry place and now it's a desert. There are many, many thousands of very poor people there. There are smaller groups that are incredibly well armed and violent. Then I would not be surprised if instances of cannibalism in that type of a situation start to show up. And I not only is that horrific, But I think that the medical community also has to keep their eyes open when this happens because of the possibility that, you know, of cannibalism-related diseases like Kuru. So beyond the gore factor, you could be dealing with outbreaks of this disease that that potentially make what took place in the 50s and 60s in New Guinea, dwarf in comparison.
And you mention the 1979... in 1973, Hollywood film Soylent Green, which seemed, for a time, I have to say, kind of cheesy and implausible. Of course, this idea that we had the Earth had become so hyper crowded, and now and real food was rare, and so we came to these crackers, these Soylent Green crackers, and it turned out that they were made, as Charlton Heston says famously, out of people. But I guess what you kind of invoke that idea and that feel that film, something to suggest that in an Earth, as you mentioned, ravaged by climate change and pollution and overpopulation, maybe it's a scenario that is not so completely implausible.
Yeah, I don't believe it is implausible. I certainly think it could happen, and that we should probably try to do everything in our power to make sure that it doesn't happen. If you look at the title of the book is Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. If you look at the animal kingdom, two of the main reasons that, that cannibalism occurs is overcrowding and a lack of food. There's no reason to believe that that would not happen, and that hasn't happened in humans in times of famine or starvation from being terrorized or besieged. So, yeah, I mean, I certainly think it could happen in the future. I sure hope it doesn't.
That's Bill Shutt. He's a zoologist and author of Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. Joined us today from his home on Long Island. Professor Shutt, thank you for taking the time.
It was a pleasure to talk to you. Take care.
Thanks. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks today to audio engineer Randy Scott Carroll in New York. The show was directed by Adrian Moranville, produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.